You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Tonight we are thrilled to present the incomparable Kate Tempest for her debut novel, The Bricks That Built the Houses. This character-rich narrative amplifies stories originally written as music tracks in Tempest's debut hip-hop album, Everybody Down, which was shortlisted for the Mercury Music Prize in 2014. Hailing from Southeast London, Tempest is both a master storyteller and an intrepid explorer of form, stretching the boundaries of genre with her much-heralded work as poet, playwright, spoken word performer, and most recently, novelist. Her dramatic poem, The Brand New Ancients, won the 2012 Ted Hughes Prize for Innovation in Poetry, making her the first ever recipient under the age of 40. The Poetry Book Society selected Tempest as one of this decade's next generation poets, and The Guardian has referred to her as one of the brightest British talents around. Joining Tempest in conversation is Nilanjana Banerjee, managing editor of Kaya Press, a small local publishing house dedicated to publishing innovative literature from the Asian diaspora. Banerjee also co-edited Indivisible, an anthology of contemporary South Asian American poetry, and The Coiled Serpent, Poets Arising from the Cultural Quakes and Shifts of Los Angeles, from Tia Chucha Press, and you can find a few copies of that book in the lobby tonight. As a contributing editor to the Los Angeles Review of Books, Banerjee is tireless in her commitment to literature and enthusiasm for innovative, diverse writers. So please join me in welcoming Kate Tempest and Nilanjana Banerjee to the Aloud stage. Hi, everyone. How's it going? I'm really excited to be here to talk with Kate about all the many genres that she works in, but also especially about the bricks that built the houses. So we're going to start our conversation, if Kate would please read a little bit from,
yeah, sure.
from the novel.
Hello. That was so good. So I'll just read a little bit from the beginning. That's usually how novels are read. It begins with a quote from William Blake, who's one of my favourite poets, and I kind of turn to him in times of crisis. I just want to put his words into the room because I think it's kind of important. There's something to be said. I'll get on and read it in a minute, but I should just say there's something to be said about this kind of this meeting of the epic and the very tiny, minute, you know, the kind of grand scale of existence as it is and the kind of tiny minutiae of life, tunnel vision that we kind of get trapped in. There's something about beginning this novel with a bit of William Blake that I hope speaks to that, you know, the loss of morphology and the kind of the lack of perspective that we have. So just begins with a quote from William and then there's a very poetic kind of voice that begins this book. It's like a kind of bridge between my other work and this work as a writer of fiction. And then it goes in, it switches into the more kind of narrative prose voice. So just as it gets all rich and like poetic, don't worry, it's going to stop in a minute. William Blake says, "They told me that the night and day were all that I could see. They told me that I had five senses to enclose me up. And they enclosed my infinite brain into a narrow circle. And they sunk my heart into the abyss. Red round globe, hot, burning." It gets into your bones. You don't even realise it until you're driving through it, watching all the things you've always known and leaving them behind. They're driving past the streets, the shops, the corners where they made themselves, and every ghost is out there staring, bad skin and sunken eyes, grinning madly at them from the past. It's in their bones, bread and booze and concrete, all the tiny moments blazing. Preachers, parents, workers, empty-eyed romantics going nowhere. Streetlights and traffic and bodies to bury and babies to make. A job, just a job. People are killing for gods again. Money is killing us all. They live under a loneliness so total it has become the fabric of their friendships. Their days are spent staring at things. They trust nothing but trends. The most that they can hope for is a night out, smashed to pieces, sloppy face from booze and drugs that hate them in the morning. But here they are, leaving. Leaving the stress and shit food and endless misunderstandings. Leaving. The job centre, the car park, the flat, the gym, the filth, the TV, the constant swiping of news feeds, the Hoover, the toothbrush, the laptop bag, the expensive hair product that makes them feel better inside, the queue for the cash machine, the cinema, the bowling alley, the phone shop, the guilt, the absolute nothingness that never stops chasing. The pain of seeing a person grow into a shadow. The people's faces twisting into grimaces again, losing all their insides in the gutters, clutching lovers till the breath is faint and love is dead. Wet cement and spray paint, the kids are watching porn and drinking Monster. Watch the city fall, but rise again through mist and bleeding hands. Keep holding on to power ballad karaoke hits. Yes, chase your talent, corner it, lock it in a cage, give the key to someone rich, and tell yourself you're staying brave. Tip the chair back. Stare into the eyes of someone hateful that you'll take home anyway. And tell the world you're staying faithful. Nothing's for you, but it's all for sale. Now give until your strength is frail. And when it's at its weakest, burden it with hurt and secrets. It's all around us, screaming paradise until there's nothing left to feel. Suck it up, gob it. Double drop it, pin it deep into your vein, then try forever to get off it. Now close your eyes and stop it. But it never stops. They leave town in a fourth-hand Ford Cortina. It's night and the city is full of itself. There is thunder in the sky, the kind of clouds that make you bow your head. They are heading for the motorway. Leon is driving. His shirt's damp with sweat. His arms are sore at the wrists from gripping the wheel. He sits low down in a driver's seat, but the top of his head still kisses the roof of the car. Leon is muscular. He's built like a fighting dog. 6'2" and light on his feet. His movements are liquid slick. Leon's face is screwed up with worry as he turns left down the road he's always known and pushes the tired engine up Blackheath Hill towards the A2 roundabout, weaving between the clattering suction of the heavy goods lorries. Now Harry's in the back, one arm stretched across the top of the seat. She's drumming her fingers, shifting her weight. She is small and getting smaller every second, her little body hunched in the back of the car, her limbs splayed like the arms of a broken umbrella. She's jittering. She clutches the brown suitcase that rests on her lap. She grips the handle so tight, its stitches are imprinted on her palm. Fear knots her shoulders and they spike together at her back like folded wings. Becky's in the front. Becky's legs are crossed tightly. Her elbows are tucked into her hip. She's biting her thumbnail. Her body is taut as a tripwire. Her features are soft and generous, like the features carved in stone on temples. Her nose is pierced with a shining stud. She has a mouth that turns up at the corners. She is tall and straight-backed with a commanding presence. Now her dark eyes stare at the dark road while the dark car shakes on its wheels. Becky watches the wing mirrors, noticing every movement, every fierce headlight. Harry watches the cars behind. Leon keeps his eyes on the road. If someone is coming after them, there's not much they can do but keep going. Now the suitcase full of money sits fat and happy as a baby. Harry can't stop glancing down at it, noticing its shape. Nobody has spoken in a full 10 minutes. The silence is loud, and it's getting louder. Eventually, Leon's voice limps from his chest and staggers out of his mouth. Out of town or what? He says. Out the country. And he hunches over the wheel. Nobody answers. The seconds pulse as they pass. It's a mess, he says. Harry thinks hard. She's breathing carefully. How serious are your uncles, Becky? And Becky sees them in her mind's eye, smiling and blood-covered. She speaks calmly, without ceremony. Depends what you've done. And her words smash through the floor of the car, rip the undercarriage into pieces and leave their feet exposed, skimming hot tarmac. Think they know you're with us? Leon asks Becky. Pete might work it out, she says. And Pete's name hangs in the air like a shot bird about to fall out of the sky, then true enough, plummets softly into their laps and sits there warm and bleeding. Pete, what a little cunt, says Leon with affection. The car returns to silence then, each alone with their panic rising, falling, rising higher. The tension clogs their mouths. Becky turns in her seat to look at Harry. Her face is lit by passing streetlights. We'll be okay, Becky smiles. And all the streets in Harry's heart are on fire. All the windows in all the houses smash at the same time. A tidal wave charges in and puts the fires out and the water floods the houses and comes pouring through the broken windows, carrying debris on its waves. And Becky turns back to the window, stares at the brief white lights of the shops they pass, seen then gone, these brutal blazing flashes like someone shouting swear words in your face. The roads are getting broader. The houses are getting bigger, fewer chicken shops now, more gastro pubs. Their city is loosening its hold. They're turning onto the motorway. And on the radio, Billy Bragg is singing A New England. There you go.
Thank you.
Special.
Sounds like trouble.
Well, it could turn out that way.
I wanted to start with this. I actually read, I think I read 75% of the novel, and then I found out about the album, about Everybody Down, and that it was a concept album that you had written that has the same characters, which I think is fascinating because to me, a novel and a hip hop album are like on opposite sides of the artistic spectrum.
So why?
I don't know because of the rhythms and the way it's produced. But yeah, tell me about for you. Is it not? What was the process of turning an album into a novel like?
Well, that's kind of interesting that you say that. The reason I ask why is because I think it's a common kind of misconception. I think that hip-hop is not a literary form, like, as valuable, as distinctive, as adventurous, probably more so than some of the other literary forms that we have kind of acknowledged as being.
I mean, I think it was more because a novel is kind of boring and oversaid, and a hip-hop album is, you know, that was my.
Okay, yeah, I forgive you. No, I was.
Just
well, that. I didn't, like, because the thing is, like, that's interesting as well that you say that, because for me, novels aren't that. Right? So, for example, like, I came to a lot of the reading material that I found when I was a teenager that really, really kind of changed my worldview and changed my life through recommendations that I heard, like, rappers talking about. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I was listening to Gravediggers quite a lot. I was listening to RZA, and, like, there was this constant kind of reference to these great books, like holy books and kind of books of ancient wisdom, and this whole idea of becoming educated, knowledge being an extremely important part of kind of self-realization and you know all this stuff. So for me, the two things are kind of linked up in some way, and just in some kind of like strange kind of, what do they call it, primordial soup? I don't know if that is what it is. But because at the time when I was discovering literature and music, in that very important moment when you realize this will bring you closer into the world, plug you more kind of fully into life, you know, in that moment when literature or music or poetry saves your life, you know, in that little bit when you're kind of 12 or 13 and you find it, I was finding it all at the same time. So I've kind of been carrying these forms around as the ultimate, for me, the ultimate forms. And then the idea came, that's a really convoluted way of answering your question, but I'm getting to it. The, The idea came for this story through writing demos in the studio towards trying to write the album. Mm-hmm. So the first demo that I made was Lonely Days, which is a track off this record called Everybody Down, which tells the same story, as you say, same characters populate it. And as I was trying to work out, in that first demo, it was just him and her, these two characters, him and her. They weren't Pete and Becky yet. And they moved around each other in this kind of story song that we made. And then it took me ages to get back in the studio with this producer because he was a big producer and I was a poet. I couldn't get into his studio. So I had all these months just like doing other work. I was working as a teacher, doing other things. And I was like, who is this him and her? Who are they? And as I started thinking about that, it kind of unlocked this story, which began to form in my mind. And then when I went back in the studio, I had written half the first draft, or half the zero draft, as we were saying backstage, like, of what became the novel. So the two things were so involved with each other from the beginning, but it just so happens that it took me much longer to write a novel than it did to make a record, which kind of speaks of the agony and the ecstasy and the length and the fucking mission it is to write a novel.
How long did it take you to produce the album?
So the album was pretty quick, you know. It's like we went, because I was so desperate at this stage to make music again, I'd taken a bit of a break from music to just kind of support myself through doing other things. And by the time, it took a long time to get some studio time. Like, once I had access to the studio, we kind of turned it around in a couple of weeks. And then we had some time away from it, went back into it, made some changes. But it was, that felt much more kind of, because you're sharing the creativity with someone else as well, it's, you kind of spur each other on and your instinct kind of leads the way, whereas with a novel, you kind of have to, rightly so, ignore your instinct a lot of the time. When your instinct is not telling you it's time to write, it's still time to write. So you've got to finish the novel, right?
Right. Okay, well, I want to spend some time talking about the novel, but I'm intrigued by this path that we just started talking about to the novel. And, you know, you were talking about that moment when you were 12 and 13, when you were kind of consuming both hip-hop and novels, and you talked about Blake. So, you know, tell us about that moment. What was your entree into hip-hop and how poetry? How did that happen? Did that happen when you were that age?
Well, poetry came much later, actually. Like, it was lyricism that really hooked me. I didn't really think poetry was for me, I don't think, for a long time, actually. Took like about 10 years, really, of kind of being in love with lyrics and music before I realised there was this thing you could do without the music. The same lyrics suddenly became poems. And you didn't need a band or a DJ. I think that's actually why I ended up doing spoken word, because I wanted to go at such a pace. I was so eager to work. I couldn't find any collaborators to keep up with me. Everyone else just was like exhausted by my kind of relentless, urgent. My friends used to call it rap attack. We'd be in a venue, just trying to have like watch a band or watch an MC or be in a rave in London. There's a big rave scene. We used to go raving all the time. And at some point in the night, I would just be staring at the MCs, being like, oh, I just need it. Like, I need to just stop all this nonsense and I want it. Like, you know, which was kind of intense and damaging and kind of really egotistic. And like, but I suppose, you know, I was 15, whatever, you're allowed. But that's kind of off the point. And I just became aware they were recording this. Damn. I'll say something much more, what's the word? My entrance into poetry was through lyricism. My entrance into hip-hop was a pretty kind of typical one. I was working in a record store in London, in South London. That came a bit later. The first rappers that I heard of were the big rappers that obviously somebody in a kind of like little tiny weird part of South London would have heard about. So it was Nas and it was Biggie, you know, and it was Wu-Tang and it was Lauryn Hill. You know, it was like what would have crossed the Atlantic and found, you know, it was mainstream, great lyricists, basically. And but at the time, it was pretty underground, I suppose. And I felt like I had just been absolutely exploded into life. I felt like I'd been given the keys to the universe, like, you know, because this was, like, the most exciting use of language I'd ever encountered. Mm. And it seemed to it also gave me so much in terms of, like, a kind of a pathway to understanding myself, my place, like especially Black British culture at the time, which is maybe a bit different to how it was here. But a lot of kind of emphasis on creativity, on intelligence, on politics, and I was really blown away, and it was part of how we socialized, it was part of my friendships, it was how we had fun, it was how we worked, you know, it was how we partied, and it became a huge part of my identity that I could walk around with these lyrics in my head. And whereas before I'd been a kind of completely invisible, I was still pretty invisible, but the minute I opened my mouth to speak, it was like I had something to say, rather than, you know, you can be dismissed if you don't enter into the mode of kind of sexual capital, especially if you're a woman trying to get on stage, you know, mm-hmm. if you don't fit that mode, mm-hmm. it's like, but if you have lyrics, then it's like, don't stop looking at me and just listen to me, you know?
Was there a big, what was the gap between, you know, that moment of hearing the music and then getting, you know, being up on stage, being spitting
like
lyrics?
5 years or so of just like loving the music, and also lots of different kinds of music I was playing. I played a bit of kind of guitar and I was playing the piano a bit. You know, I was trying to make beats, but they were kind of really shit. But my friends indulged me and let me play on there.
And then, so from that spoken word, was that a big scene? Did that?
Yeah, it was a scene, but it was a strange scene. It was like in rap, right? When I was in the UK hip hop scene, you go to a night or whatever. I was always a bit young, so sometimes I couldn't even get in, but I'd stick around for afterwards when all the rappers would be outside just having ciphers in the car parking lot, as you call it. And it was like this kind of really vibrant thing where if you had a lyric, you know, if your lyric was no good, you wouldn't dare to speak it. You know, if you were no good, they'd tell you about it. And then suddenly I found spoken word where it was like, you know, it doesn't even matter if you're no good, it's kind of well done for trying, you know? Like, yeah. And that really blew my mind. I couldn't. There seemed to be no, you know?
Right. So,
but then I met some very amazing poets, okay. And I actually discovered this whole thing called poetry and started reading poetry. And
yeah. So, kind of fast forwarding to when you were shortlisted for the Ted Hughes Award for Poetry for your book Brand New Ancient, so you know have gone from ciphers to putting out this book, and now it's getting this big award. I saw that you had tweeted, you know, people love to say performance poets aren't proper. Like, do you feel like there's a gap?
Fantastic use of language there, wasn't it? Damn. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Do you feel like there, you know, that there is a gap that you weren't get that now taking this form into a published sphere, was it a sense of that? Do you feel like you weren't getting respect, or that you are one of the first? I'm not as well aware of the scene, the poetry and publishing scene. I mean, here in the U.S., I think there is a lot of criticism of spoken word poets from book poets, and also that is called jealousy.
Mm. Because they're not as cool.
In organizing readings, as someone who organizes readings, often if there's a spoken word poet, the non-spoken word poets will like pull you in and be like, do not put me before or after that poet, you know, because there is such a difference. So, I mean, how has it been for you to kind of bridge these words, having a book and being in, you know, audience and in community now with published poets?
That's really interesting. So when in London, I should say that the spoken word community and scene is really vibrant. There is some amazing poets working in that form. You know, really, I kind of didn't mean to make light of the fact that, you know, it's not like there's some incredible artists writing some really interesting things. And I felt very lucky to have been a part of that world. You know, I met the people that I met. Then going into publishing, you know, it's the thing is, this is what I think is important to say. No bracket that you can put around an artist is ever going to be big enough to adequately contain what that artist is capable of creating, ever. And this idea of bracketing an artist is actually all about commercial capital. This is about where we can position that art in the shop so that the dumb consumer who says to themselves, and this is how they think of us, this is not what I'm saying about us, this is how we're thought of. Our kind of music fan, our consumer of literature is so pathetically blinkered that what they need is to know that what they like is this, and this is in that part of the store, so that's where we'll put the thing. That I believe this is the beginnings of telling our artists that we exist in these narrowly bracketed concepts. It doesn't make any sense to me, it never has. Like, the idea that you would be in love with language enough to stand up in front of a room full of strangers and speak your poetry, that is a huge thing. That means that you're in love with language. To think that a person who is capable of that kind of passion is somehow unqualified to love language enough to give it life on a page is a very strange kind of set of different snobberies and principles that date back, you know. But I believe that in all fields of literature, there is great stuff and there is absolute bullshit. Mm. And that is how we should be distinguishing.
Those are the genres.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like, and obviously that's completely subjective. I'm not trying to say that anybody's any, you know,
right.
Of course, what some person loves, somebody else thinks is trash. Like, that's fine. But the idea that, you know, that a poet couldn't be a musician or that a musician couldn't write a novel, which I've come up against kind of constantly within my adventures into different forms. It's like, I think also for young poets and people that they might see a video on YouTube and suddenly they're like, oh, wow, like this feels accessible to me. I would like to begin writing. That is a very important thing that happens, I think, with spoken word more than it happens for probably other forms.
Right.
I've met a lot of kids who have been like, I never read, you know, I never read poetry. I didn't even really think of it. And then suddenly I saw a video on YouTube and I thought I could be expressing myself this way. And that's a really important, very important thing to bring a child into contact with their creative power is very, like, that does not happen so much in page poetry, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, I think it's interesting, too, knowing that you came from this idea of performance, hip-hop, that so much of hip-hop is this, is persona and performance, and then you move to the page. I mean, I think it's fascinating knowing that you've performed poetry at big music venues, places like Glastonbury this year. I don't know, do they have poets at Coachella? No, I don't think so. But anyway, I mean, what do you, how does that sense of performance, is that there when you're at the desk writing? Mm. Like, does that infect your process?
That's so interesting, right? Because I have this theory, right? in the moment of writing, in the moment of creating a piece of work, the author or the musician or the poet is nowhere near their audience. You know, they are part of their community, and who they are and where they're from informs what they're thinking about and feeling. But in that moment, it's between the artist and the idea. And you have to do everything you can to accommodate the idea. And that is about something that doesn't even really involve you. It's something that happens up here, all being well. It's kind of got nothing to do with anything apart from the idea and trying to cultivate the faculties that can, you know, give it the best kind of breathing space, right? But in the moment the idea is finished, there must be a moment of performance for it to live. There must be. If for literature to ever have life, it has to be in the performance of it. And what I mean by that is, right, I've been thinking about, I've been like on this book tour for about a month, so I've like worked this out now. It's like, I believe there's this like three-pointed circuit, right? This kind of, there is the reader. Well, there is, I'll start again. There is the writer, there is the text, and there is the reader. And if all these three points on this circuit are not kind of blazing with full electricity and power, then the literature can't live. And I know this from my work as a performer, because of Brand New Ancients, what we're talking about. Brand New Ancients is a 75-minute poem that I told from memory with some musicians, and I went and we performed it in theatres. And what Kate, the writer, knew about that poem was nothing compared to what Kate, the performer, learnt about it, having committed it to memory and spoken it to a room full of people. There was this moment where the language came to life. The thing took on a whole new life force. And it made me really think about how important the reader's role is in bringing a book to life. Because, yes, we like revere our writers. Yes, we canonise them. Yes, we elevate them. And that's important because, they're, you know, we have these great, great people that have thought and made and created. But at the moment the writing is done, the reader's role is as important, in my opinion, as the writer's role in bringing that literature to life. The reason that we still have these books is because they were read. Not because they were written, you know? Well, there is obviously because they were written. But like,
right.
Do you understand what I mean? So I feel very passionately about this kind of moment, this moment of performance. I believe the reader of the novel is as important to the novel's life as the singer is to the song. Mm. And I think that because of my years and years I've spent performing and being in front of people and realising that there is this moment of exchange between, you know, your audience, your community, the people that you're talking with and to and for, which is a very important role for a poet, a writer, a musician. And the more we kind of elevate our artists and separate them from the communities that they're a part of, then the worse that is for the art. You know, it's like in other times, in other cultures, it was very important, the role of the poet. We had a role because we're extremely sensitive and we're tuned into things at this like overwhelming, exhausting frequency. in order to express things that everybody needs to hear and see and feel expressed, but some people are too blocked, too busy, you know? It's like, that is the role of the poet. Mm. And I feel very passionately about that, which is why I went off on a massive tangent. And, thanks, that's my fault. But wait, I've been thinking about this thing. Sorry, I've just, whatever. Like, but I've been thinking about this thing. Plato, I think it was Plato, he talks about the importance of art to... why do we enjoy art? Why do we enjoy it? You know, I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, who is it for? When I was hanging out in Seattle or Portland, I met a couple of guys and they were homeless guys. And one of them had this book that he was reading and this other guy, completely unrelated to that, was telling me about this poetry book he'd had since the 50s. Just because I was sitting in a park writing, they came over and we talked about books. And it's like this, and then I'm performing in venues like this, and I'm, you know, it's, yeah, like, and I'm thinking, well, who are books for? Mm. And I'm realizing how important in a humanitarian crisis, which is, I think, what we're in globally right now, literature is so important in connecting us to our humanity and teaching us empathy. It's one of the most important teachers of empathy that we have. And I say humanitarian crisis because of what's happening in Europe at the minute for the refugees. And it's something that, in these times, how can we justify making artwork, right? How can we justify it to ourselves? Why are we not doing more? You know, all this kind of stuff that goes through my mind daily. And then I'm realizing this stuff. So Plato says that the artist's job is to create, you know, it's kind of social utility, because you create this work, and through looking at, and I think he was talking about sculpture, but I think it, and plays, but I think it resonates. If you look at a play in which beautiful qualities are exhibited, things like humility and trust and, you know, empathy, it connects with those parts of yourself and it can make you a better person, right? Whereas if you put onto stages and celebrate artwork that is about greed and about hatred and about fear, that will then cultivate those parts of humanity in ourselves. So he thought that artists had a responsibility for improvement, which is, I mean, this is kind of got nothing to do with my book, so don't worry about it. This is not my book side. My book's pretty dark side and full of grit, but like, it's just been something I've been thinking about, especially in times like this, which is like the artist's role and what is our purpose and do we have a responsibility and all this thing. I'm like on this massive empathy kick at the minute, you know, so... Yeah. Sorry, you were saying. Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, you're right. You know, really turning to the novel now. The novel is dark and gritty, and the characters are very caught up in their lives.
Yeah.
But I think the way the novel, for me, you know, listening to the album, I was telling Kate that I've been listening to the album in my car, of course, because we're in LA, over the last week, and it has so much drive, because as you saw with that first chapter, there's kind of a crisis. These characters are gonna find themselves in a fix of sorts and try to get out of it. But you know, I think along with these characters, so the novel focuses on a few main characters. Becky, who's a dancer, Harry, short for Harriet, and Leon, who sell cocaine, Harry's brother, Pete. But along with these, the stories of these characters, we get just so many backstories of all of the families of these characters and their friends, the people who make up this community of Southeast London. And I wanted to kind of hear about that choice. I mean, that was, for me, one of the big differences between the album and the novel was just this, you know, the novel was like these portraits of these characters, and then the novel was this huge mural of the community. So I wanted to know about that choice. And I also, you know, I mean, hearing you've been on tour, you're from this specific place, but you've now probably been all over the world, and Do you still live in the neighborhood where you grew up? What is it about this neighborhood that, I mean, it seems to be a major theme in all of your work?
Okay, so I'll start from that point and work backwards through the question. Okay. So the reason that it's a major point in all my work is because I have been working towards this part of my work for the past 5 or 6 years. The idea is that all of the works that I've produced are connected. They are populated by the same cast. They happen in the same place. They are in communication with each other. They are like a constellation that don't need each other to exist, but there is a pleasing kind of symmetry, I hope, between them all. Maybe the exception to that is Hold Your Own, which was a poetry collection. But actually, Hold Your Own is also based very firmly in a place and is also kind of dealing with similar issues. So it could be kind of incorporated into this batch of work that I've been dealing with, gestating, and have now at last got to the end of. Like, it's been dealing with lots of things that have been huge inside my brain and heart and body for all my life, which is about my youth and young adulthood growing up where I'm from. And even though it's a very localized story geographically, I believe that the more localized you are about the story that you're trying to tell, the more universal it can be, because it's about home and it's about, you know, what you need to leave behind, what you seek to escape and what you take with you. Like, when you're from a place like South London, it informs everything I do as soon as I leave South London. I take it with me. It's the way that I look at a new city that I'm in. It's the way I engage with people that I talk to. It gives me good manners and it gives me good strength. Like, you know, it's something, it's a huge part of my fabric, just in the same way that anybody carries that childhood within them. And I suppose that my work is an articulation of everything that's going on in my brain at the time. But I feel like at last I've got to the end of this body of work that's kind of been brewing and has been informed by each other. And I'm now ready to kind of actually move on to what I feel is my serious... These are my serious years now, I feel. I feel like I'm getting to the point where over the next 10 years, like, you don't want to know what's going on in my brain at the minute, because it's like, it's, I mean, it's pretty terrifying, but like, just give me another 10 years, it'll be all right. So then move backwards to what you were saying about the album and the novel.
Yeah, the detail of the community that is really included.
So the album is 48 minutes long, it's sharp, it's clear. The idea was always that it was going to be as kind of quick as it possibly could be. I'm obsessed with storytelling raps, like I've always been a sucker for them. And when the idea hit that I could maintain a narrative over 12 tracks, it was an idea that completely sucked me in, and I just knew it just had to be really quick and clear, and like all the flab had to be cut off it. It had to just be driving. And some of the first versions of those songs were like 7, 8, 9 minutes long, and we cut them and we cut them and we cut them. It was like a really amazing process to go through with lyrics, which I hadn't done before. And then when it came time to write the novel, I just wanted this space. I wanted depth. And also I wanted, because it's so much about the city, when you grow up in a place, you know everything about not just your mates, but you know who their parents are. You know everything about their little sister. Even if you don't want to, you just know it. Like, it's just, do you know what I mean? So I kind of wanted to give the novel that kind of feeling of claustrophobia, but also true depth, you know. But then again, it's kind of unusual for a novel. What you're meant to have is a hero, usually male, who moves through some kind of circumstances and then is successful at the end, or kind of falls into disrepute. But you follow one narrative, usually a male guy will kind of go through it and we'll be the hero, and then we can all identify with him, or in my case, you know, not, and hate ourselves for the fact that we can't. But when you create a cast of players in a piece of work who are different generations, you know, that we're not the present tense. The present tense is a kind of tiny little needle point that is informed by this huge kind of curtain of the past, which pushes forwards. Like, it's pushing this like tiny point forwards and forwards. If I've already created this story on wax, you know, on a record, then why, and I've told it in 48 minutes, why do I need to go into it and tell it again? Well, the idea is that the present tense, the plot of this novel, although it kind of, there's a kind of drugs caper and there's a runaway and there's all this, that, it isn't for me really the point. The reason I wanted to use the form was because of everything that informs the present tense. The idea being, at what point does a person begin to become the person that they are? Like, you know, there's all these bigger questions. And there is a reason people don't write novels like that. And it's because it doesn't really work. It's kind of relentless and exhausting. And I'm sure that some people reading it will feel maybe lost or something. Some people really enjoy it. And I think that the people where I'm from that have read it, they've been super cool about it. But I think that for other people, maybe it was too ambitious for my first novel. But I will say that I'm very proud that I've got to the end of what was a really difficult process, because I was on tour while I was writing this, you know, like I was writing in the back of the van. I was writing, like, trying to get my head around lots of things about lots of characters. When you write a novel, you have to have a universe in your head at all times. You have to know everything about everybody, even if you, the reader, end up not knowing that, because thankfully I cut it out. Like, it's very important that you've done that work with it. So it was like, it's been a heavy burden, and I think getting to the end of this whole process, now I'm ready to begin. Mm. But, you know, I've done it now. So novel two is going to be slimmer.
Well, one of the big differences that I noticed was in the hip-hop album, Harry, the character of Harry, was referred to as a man. You use the pronoun he. But in the novel, Harry, like I mentioned before, is short for Harriet, and there's we get a lot more. I mean, and they're the same person. Hmm. They're completely the same person. They're driven and professional and doing the work, being a professional, very professional, I have to say. I like the way that's written. Cocaine dealer in order, it's a means to a different end. Hmm. But in the novel, we get a lot of the struggle that Harriet has gone through with her sexuality, with her family, and so tell us about this change.
Well, how did it make you feel reading it? Like knowing that, not going from the album to the novel.
Well, I went the other way because I'd read most of the novel first, and it was nice because the album is so tight, it didn't feel different.
Yeah, interesting.
Right? It didn't have a difference for me because it was the same person.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I don't know how it will feel to read the novel and then hear the record. Like, I've got no idea how that will feel. Mm. That's so cool.
Yeah.
The gender change, I mean, there is a lot that I wanted to say about... There was a truth that was missing from Harry. But Harry, the character Harry, began as a male, right? In the first couple of drafts of this, you know, I was late for my deadlines, and my editor was like ready for me to submit, and then I was like, okay, I've just had an idea, and it's just a small thing, but and completely rewrite it. But I knew that Harry had to be a woman. I knew it. It was more truthful. It was more real. It made the love story more believable. It was able to say more what I wanted to say, but had been a bit afraid of saying, really. I didn't want it to become completely about that. I didn't want people to think it was a story about lesbians rather than human beings, you know? Which is like, and once I did do a Q&A in Manchester, and the interviewer was like, so in the record, in the album, Harry's a man, but in the novel, Harry's a lesbian.
Oh, no.
Woman. Woman. Human woman. So it's like so all of these things were kind of creeping me out and making me feel like I couldn't quite commit to it. But then I just knew it had to happen. Also, something interesting happens when you write a character, when you write a female character. I had to really work to create Becky. The first couple of drafts, I realised Becky, my female protagonist, was really passive. It was like, and like suddenly she was caught. She was the accessory to this kind of other character's agency. The other character is male and her boyfriend. Suddenly it was like, oh, how have I done this? Like, how have I fallen into this trap? But Harry, who began life as a male character, I just tried it out, switched the pronouns in a couple of paragraphs. Suddenly, surprise, surprise, was this kind of whole, living, strong, really interesting character who felt like a rounded human being. But in order to create that for Becky, which I hope I've managed to do, I'm not sure, I had to work so hard. But to do that for Harry, it was just a question of changing the pronoun. Mm. You know what I mean? Which is kind of devastating, but interesting. You know, there are conventional narrative traps that we fall into even when we've decided that we're not going to. You know, it's really interesting. But then obviously once I realised that she was going to be a woman, I rewrote the character, it informed so much about who she was, I kind of completely fell in love with her. She was super cool and... Lots of people think she's based on me, but I know that she's not because I know who she's based on, and it's not me. It's a very cool, very cool woman that I wish was me, but she's like my idol. So I'm kind of secretly pleased that people think.
But you have a long poem, Tiresias, as well, that is about... in that poem, kind of based on the classic figure, also goes through like a gender change in the poem.
Yeah, did that come? Goes through a couple.
Yeah, did that come before? Were you thinking about that before or after at the same time as this?
Interesting. So because I've been working in such furious intense bursts. They all kind of came about at the same time. I was working on Hold Your Own while I was touring Everybody Down, while I was writing this novel, it's all been part of the same primordial soup. Interesting. Twice in one day, after never before uttering those two words. The thing about Tiresias is that I have been carrying this figure, this mythic figure, around in my brain for 10, 11, 12 years. I first encountered him as the blind prophet that is wheeled on at the end of other people's tragedies, usually to tell great kings things they don't want to know, and then getting like terribly punished for it. And I was just fascinated by who this guy was, why he was always carted on at the end of things to deliver this like poet, this doom poetry about the truth. He's the one who told Oedipus what Oedipus did, you know, or Oedipus, as we say here. But So he's been like with me for a long time. And when I was trying to think about Hold Your Own, which was a poetry collection, this was a big deal for me, this poetry collection, because I, for many years, was self-publishing. No publisher would come near me. I was a spoken word poet. I was even worse, a rapper. They would not come near it. And like, so I set up a publishing company, and because I knew that I had people wanted to buy books, you know. It was a commercial decision that I made. I rail against capitalism. I'm like, oh, no! But so I made all these books and everything. Anyway, this fantastic editor, Don Patterson, heard my work eventually and decided that he wanted to sign me up to this poetry publisher, Picador, which is kind of revered. It's a big deal. And I wanted this poetry collection to be so much. I wanted every poem to be new. I wanted it to be a new direction. I wanted to use the page in a way that I had up to this point never done. You know, Don Patterson taught me that the page can perform things that a stage can't. You know, you can't perform a semicolon, is what he told me. Mm. Which is like, I mean, you probably could. We worked hard enough at it. But like, so I had this whole massive idea about Hold Your Own, and I realised that everything I wanted to say could be structured around the mythic retelling of Tiresias' story, which is like an incredible story, and one that I think gives the collection a kind of, you know, a seriousness that without it, it might have lacked. I think it's very important that in order for me to go into the more personal poems, it had to have a mythic context. Because I believe very much, as I was saying earlier on about mythology, I believe that we have a collective mythology that we share in our deepest levels, in our dreams. There is something that connects us together, and I think that we've been severed from it, and it is responsible for a lot of the pain and the anguish and the neuroses that people are going through. So I knew I needed to have, you know, a kind of pansexual prophet featured in my in my poetry collection.
Wow. All right, well, that's been...
On that note...
We're already kind of burned through our time pretty quickly, but I'll ask Kate... one more question, but I think we're going to get ready for the Q&A, so please prepare your questions. We'll have microphones in the audience. But so, I mean, the novel has, like you were saying, it's a drug caper. It has action, romance, tragedy, danger, poetry. You know, it felt to me Shakespearean, but also like a really literary episode of Skins. I know you've talked about some of, you know, the classic writers that influence you. Does pop culture influence you? I mean, you've also talked about your hip hop influences. Like, what are some of the kind of more, you know, modern influences on your work?
Well, of course, pop culture influences me because I'm alive, you know, right. And like I exist in this time. So of course, like, you know, and I think that I personally set no distinction between what I receive and I'm inspired by. Like, I have no time for the notion of high and low art. Mm. I think it's an arbitrary delusion which is about control of beauty. Mm. And I think it's fucking disastrous that it's still so successful and pernicious, you know, in our time. Anyway, that's for another panel. So the idea is that if I get blown away by something, whether it's a movie or a TV show or a conversation like over here on the street or a poem, or, you know, if it reaches me, it reaches me. And I feel very blessed to have been reached in that way, you know, like, so, I mean, I can't really reel off a kind of convenient list of inspirations, but I feel like everything that is kind of, that kind of informs, yeah, the drugs capers probably came. It's me kind of tipping my hat to the legendary drugs capers that you find in hip hop songs. You know, like I'm talking about Biggie Story. I got Biggie Smalls. I got a story to tell. You know, or like. Right, do you know what I mean? So when I sat down to write The Heist, that's what I was listening to and that's what I wanted to pay homage to. And I mean, Slick Rick obviously was, yeah, he was born in London, you know. I can still claim him as a London boy. Like, I can, so it's like there's all these kind of references maybe to that, but then at the same time, I grew up watching gangster films. When I was a kid, all my best friends were boys, still are, and there's nothing wrong with that. They're brilliant. I don't know what that interjection was about, but I used to spend my teenage years just hanging out with like a group of lads. Like that was my pals. That was like that's what my environment was: smoking weed and kind of watching gangster films. So it's in me. Do you know what I mean? And we mentioned Goodfellas in this book, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I embarked on this kind of whole journey towards like the romantic poetry of the 19th century and whatever else. So it's like. All of these things are like smashing around inside my brain, plus South London, plus mythology, plus whatever else, you know? It's like, it's there. And it's also here.
All right. It seems like a good segue to open it up to questions. So these guys are going to.
So, is this on? Okay, thank you. This is such a great talk. I really appreciate what you had to say about empathy. I wanted to ask what you, if you have been exposed to or have any thoughts about the show Hamilton, and just make a quick observation that at a time when I find our political discourse to be hair-raising and frightening and upsetting, that's how I feel about our American political discourse. For me, the way I'm moved by Hamilton is I feel like these people have found a point of empathy with the people who had the original brilliant idea for the country that is the best version of our country and found a way to get an empathetic connection to the next generation. So to me, it's like my antidote for what's happening. Like that's how it's so important, this piece of art for me right now. I don't know if you've even been, you know, have an interest in
so
Hamilton
well,
or have
I
any
suppose
thoughts about
like
it.
I should be honest with you saying, I don't know really what you're talking about. I was like, I'm sorry.
Well, it's a show on Broadway. It's a huge hit. Sorry to bring up something that you hadn't heard of. I thought.
Oh,
you
it's
might
my have. Fault.
No,
I'm
no,
like, yeah,
no.
Pop culture. What?
You'll love it. I swear.
Okay. Cool.
I think. Well, just to briefly, you should check it out. It's basically a somebody who started as Lin-Manuel. He started as a spoken word. He's a poet, and so it just won like the Pulitzer for best. Theater piece, but it's totally.
Oh,
like,
okay, yeah,
word,
yeah.
Rap,
no,
like,
I know
yeah.
this thing. Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay, wicked. No, yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay.
Next question, right over here.
Mm-hmm. How you doing, Kate?
Yeah, doing good. Thank you.
Good, good, good. I'm a big, 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 big fan. I'm an instructor. I think you said a moment ago you were a teacher.
Yeah, for a little.
And so
while.
It's interesting because I'm also a big hip hop fan.
Yeah.
Started listening to hip hop around 13 or 14 and literature at the same time. So I'm half nerd, half hip hop head.
Yeah.
I identify with you on that level. So in one of my classes, we explored your song Theme from Becky.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were talking about privilege at the time. So yeah. We had talked about white privilege, we talked about American privilege, and then we were looking at Theme from Becky and we were talking about male privilege in that song, and we struggled with it a little bit. It was the first time, you know, your accent, according to us, we had to figure out some words and figure out what we're saying, so we're figuring that out. And then we got through that, and then we were like, okay, so we think Becky's a sex worker, and like, you know, what's that about? Is that a positive choice? Is she a liberated woman? Is she, you know, she degraded? How do we feel about this? And we were just so curious, and we explored, and we just left it there. You know, we had our opinions, and we left it there. And I had promised to, you know, come here tonight and talk to you and ask you, can you tell me like what's up with Becky? Like, tell us a little bit more about Becky. What you know, who is she? Give me some more about.
I
got the book. I will read it, and I will
assign
it. Yeah,
no, she's in here.
Like, I know, but just if you could tell me just a little bit so I can take it back to my students.
So Becky is a sex worker, and she is completely fine with that decision. You know, she's made her decision that this is how she wants to support herself and make her money. She feels safe in that decision, and she feels empowered by it.
She's an artist, as I think
She's working like this. She's supporting herself. She's a dancer. She needs to pay for dance classes, which are expensive, and she's trying to move from a kind of commercial dance world into a more kind of creative or contemporary dance setting, which she's finding really difficult. Anyway, within the context of her sex work, which is how she makes her living, it's everybody else that has a problem with it. But there is something interesting, I think. I mean, I believe personally that sex work should be legal. I think that there is so much articulation about women as sex workers often made by men, about a derogatory term for a woman, you know, for making her money and living that way. What I think is important to say in this context is that for the people at the top of society, they are free to make their money in the most disastrous, immoral, absolutely disgusting ways. But legal, absolutely legal, at the bottom of society, when people have got nothing else but their own bodies, that is still being controlled by law. The way that you make your money, you're so oppressed that even that is illegal. So how can we have, recently we had this huge scandal where it was revealed, surprise, surprise, that all of the kind of billionaires, top politicians, all these people have got their money in offshore accounts. They're not paying tax in our country. But it's completely legal. They can do whatever the fuck they like because they own the laws. They've bought the laws. But at the bottom of society, for a woman who needs to support herself, she still has to break the law in order to sustain herself. So there is hopefully a message of positive, as they call it, sex positive kind of literary creation in Becky. You know, I hope that people will hear that song and read this chapter and maybe think again before they judge a woman who is using what she has in a safe way as far as she can to support herself, you know.
Back there.
Oh. Rock, paper, scissors. Hello.
Hello.
So I think most raps are non-narrative, right? They like just kind of wander around and like can talk about anything. And I think that's like one of the things that like makes them so fresh and like hit so hard is that they just come out of nowhere. They're just like coming with the next thing that rhymes. But at the same time, I know like Slick Rick and Mobb Deep and Nas, and they all have these like really amazing storytelling raps. And it's always kind of baffled me. So I was just wondering, like, you mentioned that you liked storytelling raps, like, what makes a good storytelling rap, and like, how do you make one?
Okay, so, well, first of all, it depends what you mean, because you began that by saying, you know, most raps aren't narrative, but I believe differently, because it depends what you take for a narrative. So for me, like, a rhyme, a poem, a rap lyric, it's a soliloquy. It's a person working out live in front of you something that's going on in their own heads about their own life or whatever, you know? And in that moment, you are entering into somebody's story. So even if you're listening to somebody talking about what they were doing last night or what they're going to do next night or how, whatever, you know, whatever they're talking about, in that moment, you're entering into a story with them. And then for me, that's a narrative. Like, okay, so there are more specific storytelling raps when there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. Like, you know, and somebody's telling you about a particular thing that happened, you know, this thing with this, you know, there is a story to it, or somebody's playing a character. There's a lot of character raps that are really interesting. You could think about Andre 3000 and what he did with the whole Love Below. You could understand that as a concept record, you know. Mm. A Life in the Day of Benjamin Andre is probably the kind of ultimate pinnacle of that. You know, it's a really interesting understanding. Ghostface Killah does it all the time. You know, like when you think about the character that he's inventing for himself. And also what he's inviting you to participate in when he addresses you directly in his narrative, you know, it's really interesting, and it's like it's everywhere. Because I love the form, and because I've suddenly found myself as a literary figure, that is the way that I engage with everything at the minute, because that's where my head's at. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure that I could probably find a story in most albums, at least, if not in the singles, you know. Cool, no worries.
What's up, Kate? Thanks for being here. It's me. Okay. Hi here. My question is for someone who loves rap. what's it like to be here in LA right now, this city with such a huge and deep connection to rap and the history of hip hop? What's it like to be here?
It's a bit of a pilgrimage, you know. It's like, especially, but I mean, not just rap, but for the music that's coming out of LA right now, you know. For me, it's a really important place, and I feel a bit blown away, you know, just even just seeing the signs on, like, the road names. I'm like, shit, that's a real thing. But, you know, like the Kamasi Washington record, or, you know, everything that's coming out of Brain Feeder at the minute, for me, it's like, I'm a musician as well, you know, so it's, there seems to be an incredible, like, very brave, like, epic, like, the kind of scale and psychedelia that's coming out, and, like, under this heat, you know, like, I'm walking around like there is something magic at work here. And especially, we were talking about this earlier, on the flip side of which is this kind of superficiality that exists in terms of everybody's in the movies or trying to get that way. Like, you can't get an Uber without it being someone famous or on their way to it, you know, like, and there's just this interesting kind of mix of, like, mythology, like hip hop mythology, and then, like, this current interesting, like, kind of, yeah, this dark psychedelia is maybe a way that I would... Because, I mean, I like psychedelic music, so that's kind of how I understand it. And then mixed with this kind of superficiality and this, like, very wealthy and very kind of plastic. Like, I see women walking down the street that make me want to just, like, hide forever, you know? It's like, I can't believe we're the same species. I'm like, ah. You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, God. But then at the same time, it's like there's this undercurrent of, like, yeah, just raw creativity. So I feel, yeah, I'm happy to be here, you know? Is the short answer to that.
Hi, thank you so much. I've been a fan for years. And I think I'm one of those people who saw a YouTube video. And soon after that, I went and did my first spoken word. So thank you. My question has to do with what you said. You mentioned a couple things. One was the intense sensitivity and just feeling things, your mind, your heart, and your whole body. I write poetry, and I'm also a musician, and I also write fiction. And the thing that I really, one of the things I really admire about you is your courage and how much you put out, because you talk about the gestation. And so I feel like there's the gestation, and then there's the sharing. And I just wonder how you find, because there's always more you could do.
Okay, that's a good question. So there is... one difference between an artist and someone who wants to be an artist. And that difference is the artist has finished something, right? So the agony that you go through in finishing a piece of work, in saying, this is it now, it's horrendous. But living through that agony is what makes you an artist, right? It's not having the idea. Everybody's got ideas. Everybody's got the best idea you've ever heard, and they're quick to tell you about it all night long if you bump into them
at the
bar.
Especially in this town.
You know, it's like everyone's got an idea. Fine, brilliant, have ideas. But if you don't finish the ideas, you know, you don't know the agony of what it is, because an idea is perfect. It's beautiful. It has wings. It's going to change the world. It's going to save the world. It's going to articulate the most important message. The finished thing is clunky, it's shit, you can't bear it, it doesn't say what you wanted it to say. Dealing with that agony is what equips you for then moving on and creating something else. And these things, these are stepping stones on a journey towards finding your voice. Now, for example, this is not the same for everyone. Some artists, they take 20 years, they make one album and it's the best thing you've ever heard. And that's, I mean, fair enough, like, I respect that. But I feel like time is against me. For some reason, I felt that. I have an urgency to my creative process where I cannot keep it in. And I know that I don't have time to kind of perfect, because I can't ever perfect it, because it's never going to be as good as the idea. And there is this moment of self-hatred, of doubt, where you think, when did I ever imagine I deserve to be a writer? There is this moment. That is the moment that makes you the writer. Dealing with that, feeling like I can't get out of bed today, I don't want to write today, I cannot do this today, and knowing you have to do it because you have to finish the thing. So, like, that's all I'm saying really is, like, finish things.
I think we have time for one more question.
Two more?
Okay.
Thank you very much. I wanted to talk a little bit about that creative process you were describing, and you did something where you went up here, and I, whether you're aware of it or not, but I would love you to speak a little more about it, because I do find the creative process so mysterious when it works, apropos the idea to finishing the product, whatever the medium. And the few attempts I've made that I felt like were successful just in my own feeling of, I articulated, I got it out, what I was feeling, and I don't know what came through. Honestly, I'm very impressed with your ability to describe your process, because for me it is such a mysterious one.
Interesting. Yeah.
To why it works and finishes.
So I agree with you. It is completely mysterious. The reason that I'm able to describe it is because I've just spent literally a month on the road having to describe it. it's interesting what you say, because when all is going well, it's got nothing to do with you. You know, there is this thing, this kind of fallacy that exists in the arts, which is like you create this thing, and then once it's finished, you talk about it in interviews or whatever else. You're not the best person to talk about the decisions that you made. That's not for you to even say. If I was to tell the truth and be like, I don't really know. that's a terrible thing to say, because obviously I worked extremely hard and every decision is a decision made. But there is a moment before the decisions, before it becomes about craft, when there is this moment of creativity where what you create comes from the same place from which you were created. And like, I will go that deep with it. It's like, because this, for me, I have had access to that place, so I work as a performer. When you're in that space and you're summoning and you're conjuring, you enter this space. And I know that space. When all is very well, like on stage especially, I can get back there. And the words don't come from here, they come from up here, or they come from somewhere about here, and they go through. And it sounds kind of far-fetched, but that's the reality of how it feels. You feel like you're channeling, like it feels like that, you know. When you're writing, for me, there may be a moment or two of that, but generally speaking, it's just hard work. It's just chiseling. Like, there is this moment of rush and fury and beauty, and it comes from this place. And then there is this kind of laborious chiseling, and that, you know, where you put in all the work that you put in. I've been writing 15 years, so that when my brain is attacking me, I can ignore my brain and trust my hand, you know, trust my ear, trust my mouth. Like, and that's kind of a very different process to this beautiful creative process, which is why we live the lives that we live, you know. But I have access to that place less as a writer, more as a poet, and more as a speaker of poems. Like, that's where I, when there is a performative aspect, a kind of exchange, that's when it really comes for me. And especially music unlocks that as well. It's a beautiful place. And that kind of transcendence, I'm going to just go deep because it's not, you know, why not? Like, but I've been reading Jung recently. I've been reading Jung's The Red Book, right? Which is fucking insane. This guy did a 15-year experiment to meet his soul, to rediscover his mythology. He's the forefather of psychoanalysis. He's like every day dealing with people who have psychosis, and he's trying to understand if there is a kind of, he's the guy that invented the collective unconscious, right? And he talks about in this book, which I've just found when I was at my weakest, actually, found it in a bookshop, walked into a bookshop, it was on a plinth in the middle of the room, open. Do you know what I mean? One of them ones. He talks about the soul of the times, the spirit of the times versus the spirit of the depths. And this is something that is throughout my work all the time. That's what I said at the beginning about William Blake. The spirit of the times, meaning your role, your achievements, your who you think you are, and the spirit of the depths, the stuff that is communicated to you from a place that you do not understand, but it's in you. This thing that joins us all, our ancestry, this common mythology that is deeper than all of this. And that's where you go, I think, when you are creating. You go to that place. And it's a very real place. And in the age of reason, as Jung would put it, we have become severed from that place, because there is, you know, it cannot be explained. It's beyond explanation, but it's very real. And actually, I think that a lot of the sickness in the culture and the sickness that we carry through our lives is because we have been detached from this very real experience of going somewhere bigger than yourself, you know. And I feel the artists among us are very lucky if we have experienced entering that mode, because that's reality, really. That's more real for me than, you know, fucking advertising and 9 to 5 and not knowing your neighbours and not being able to articulate the reality of how you feel to those closest to you, and, you know, the push and the rush and the fumes of life, you know, and the lack of empathy, and walking past somebody who's in trouble, sleeping wrapped up in a sleeping bag, you know, on the floor, and rather than thinking, my gosh, that human being, are they okay? You don't want them to ask you for anything because you're afraid. You know, that thing that happens to people, that fear, that's not humanity. That's not it. That's not what our bones and our blood and our bodies are for, like, you know? So for me, that creative process, I went off on a tangent, but I've been reading Jung, so you've got to forgive me. But you know what I mean? It's like... So I just finished the point I'm making, which is it is the most human thing. It's the most human thing you can do, for me, is to experience artwork. It brings you more deeply and more intuitively into your humanity, because it connects you to the humanity of others. And you know, and that's the point, I suppose.
And okay. I think we'll end there. And thank you, Kate, for your deep humanity. Thank you, Neela. Please join me in thanking Kate.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.